This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Links and Linguistics: Why Word Choice Matters in Writing.
This week's episode is brought to you by the weird connection between Jules and I when we're far apart from one another.
Yes, I suggested it because obviously I'm a complete word nerd and, you know, I want to bring everybody on board with me, or at least make you suffer. apparently Madeleine was teaching it earlier in the week, so...
She was like, hey, how do you feel about that? Is this a bit... And I was like, no, I'm game. So
there you go. We've merged into a single entity, just living separate lives in separate parts of the country.
That's the twist.
That is the twist. Oh no, it's going to be like Fight Club. One of us will have imagined the other all the way through.
That's right, listeners. This entire podcast is in fact just one person doing slightly different voices.
Or worse, only one voice has been recorded all the way. So you've got 260 episodes of one person having one side of a conversation.
Or maybe both sides. Maybe they're just like, I just really like the conversational side to the podcast. You know, clearly it's the same person, but I like that they've created these two characters. If only they could vary their voices a little more. Yeah, that's what it is. The question is, who's real, Jules? You or me?
Good question.
Anyway, tangent aside.
Yeah.
Jules is a nerd, so she suggested this episode is how we summarise that little debacle.
Yeah, I want to talk about etymology and linguistics and stuff like that. So,
yeah,
this is fun. I suppose in broad terms, this is kind of a finessing type episode. So if you're a newbie writer, and I know we have a lot more newbie writers who are listening to the podcast now, and, you know, hi, shout out to you guys. Please don't panic. This is not something you need to be applying from day one. This is something for you to think about in the future when you're more comfortable.
Yeah. It's... I mean, simply put, I know we're making little jokes about you being a nerd, but if I'm perfectly if I'm allowed to put my stance forward, words are fun.
Words are definitely fun.
They're fun. They're cool.
Knowing where they've come from.
Yeah.
What their evolution of things. That's a lot of fun, definitely.
It is. It's a lot of fun. And I guess I know it sounds really stupid, but words literally are the building blocks of stories, of writing, and writing is by and large about word choice.
Ultimately, it's, you know, I've written it down, it's a game played on many levels, and it absolutely is. And we have talked about planning and plot and structure, we've talked about through line and style and theme and various other aspects of writing. But at the end of the day, that's all completely useless if you haven't got prose.
And one single word can make all the difference. It really can. So much so that you've kind of, in order to really get your writing to that next level, you've got to appreciate the significance of a single word change. To give you an example, just to give you a very simple one for anyone who's listening to this going, what the hell are they talking about? House and home, those two words. So I was talking about this in terms of sort of advertising or things like that when I was teaching. And an example I said is, if you had a line that said security for your house, and then you changed it to security for your home, the second one is immediately more appealing, because house, even though house and home, you know, you could say that they're synonyms for one another, one is generic, one is personal. And it's one word change which completely differs the image that comes to your mind when you think of the word house. You might think of any house, you might think of a generic house, but when you think of home, the concept of home is so deeply tied with family, with the place that you love. And again, this might be found family, this might be friends, etc. That suddenly, you know, security for your home means so much more than house, because it suddenly means security for your family, for the things you love, for your pets, for your possessions, etc. One word choice has completely changed it. Similarly, another good example, and this one I've definitely nicked from the internet, is the big difference between saying someone whispered and someone said softly. So another really good little example for you there is if you had, "I'm right here," she whispered, and then you had, "I'm right here," she said softly. That is a tiny difference, and yet the implications immediately change. "I'm right here," she whispered, makes it sound like whispered. It implies almost something a little bit sneaky. You don't want to be heard. You've got to keep quiet. So it sounds like two people stood in the dark and one of them's signalling to the other where they are. Whereas, "I'm right here," she said softly. Softly is a choice. It's not, "I have to be quiet." It's, "I am choosing to be quiet." And suddenly that sounds like comforting words instead. Again, tiny, tiny change, but they really make a big difference. And that's what Jules and I are talking about.
Yeah. And you can even muddy the waters further and say murmured or muttered, or use, you know, I wouldn't say, certainly, particularly if you're looking for alternatives to the word said, I wouldn't say go to a thesaurus every time, because really your best word is nearly always said.
Yeah.
However, having a thesaurus is definitely handy, simply because when you're talking about a massive battle scene, you won't say that everyone is butchered every single time. Because
no.
The word stops losing its meaning within the context of the story, and it sounds like lazy writing. So some of this, again, is also, as well as context, it's avoiding laziness.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's that. Before anyone panics, this is not an episode about grammar. I like grammar. Again, we've established I'm a bit of a nerd. And if you intend to write professionally, you should probably brush up on your grammar. Just because if you want to break the rules, you should probably know what they are in the first place.
Yeah.
But we're not going to be all grammar Nazi, spelling Nazi about anything with this one. This is not what this is about. This is literally about playing with words.
Yes, absolutely. Again, because I'm so nerdy when it comes to words and things like that, it's one of the first things I always do whenever I have like a writing group. I'm like, okay, choose your favorite words. And they're like, what do you mean our favorite words? I'm like, your favorite words, which words taste the best in your mouth? And everyone's like, what?
Well, that's an interesting point. And not to go off at too much of a tangent, but I have lexical synesthesia, which means that my senses are mixed up on certain things in very particular ways with words, as in letters have their own individual colours, feelings and things like that. Mm. Words will have different flavours, colours, feelings, sometimes smells associated with them. Don't know why my brain does it, it just does. Mm. There are definitely advantages and disadvantages to this. And actually you find quite a lot of writers have some form of this, whether they're projecting or associating. It's really, really interesting.
Yeah.
Although if you're a writer who doesn't, it's fine as well.
Yeah, it is fine. I guess the whole point is that words are fun, and if you can enjoy them on an individual level, if you can appreciate them on an individual level, then you can start to mix and merge and play around with them with even more ease and even more creativity.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so final, breaking open a small can of worms here. When you're talking about writing and language, a lot of people go straight to sort of literary fiction. And there's a good reason for that, obviously, because literary fiction is very much about style. Mm. It gets a bit frustrating for those of us who are genre writers, which both Madeline and I are.
Yeah.
When it's assumed that we don't have the same sort of connection to language.
Yes.
Because this is patently not true. And if you ask any genre writer worth their salt, they'll go, oh, absolutely, the language choice is important. Just because in fantasy, sometimes good fantasy means that you make the language, the delivery method of the story, almost invisible, so it's not jarring the reader out of the suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
That's still a skill, you know?
Absolutely, yeah. Oh, absolutely. One way I see it is that, think of it like architecture, right?
Yeah.
Making a house accessible doesn't in any way make it less of a beautiful house or
no, absolutely.
Or anything like that. You know, adding a wheelchair ramp or anything like that doesn't mean that suddenly, oh, well, it's not a classic Georgian house. You know, it's got a stair lift and stuff like that. Yeah, fine. It's just been made more accessible. But just as much care, and if sometimes even more care, has been placed into making it accessible, into making sure that each word is consumable and enjoyable to the people who are there to read it, to enjoy it. So, yeah, I do get very frustrated with a few sneery kind of people who just sort of think that clever wordplay or sort of appreciation of words and the building of language is all down to literary fiction, because it absolutely isn't.
Definitely. And I wouldn't ever call myself a literary writer, but I don't necessarily do prose that is just plain all the time either. So particularly when I'm talking about landscape or something like that, I might not douse you with poetry, but I do get you get a connection between land and emotion, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've got to say, Jules, you are the only writer so far to date where I have felt like every time I go to a place with your characters, I feel like I'm actually on holiday. Like, I get that very particular sense that because I'm a big traveller, and there's a very particular feeling you get when you arrive in a place just before you start exploring, and that there's that kind of this bubbling excitement of, oh, what are we going to see? And I'm somewhere different. And I get that every time you read the books. You have these sweeping descriptions of the place, and I'm like, oh, what a lovely place. And then you ruin it by, you know, having a murder or something.
I was going to say, yeah, it's kind of like, read Jules's books, go on holiday with monsters. It's just kind of, that's what happens.
I mean, to be honest though, the problem is that because I'm just like that, all I can think of is every time I finish or I'm reading your books, Jules gets these messages like, hey, let's go to Cornwall together and try and find ghosts. Jules! Let's go on a hunting trip, Jules! Let's
Real
find
game.
Let's
definitely.
Find Nessie. So yes. I agree, and the other thing is that I have read some of the most beautiful writing in genre fiction, and I have seen some what I would personally deem to be appalling writing in literary fiction. So
yeah, two examples just popped into my head just like that, you know.
Would you like to share?
Haruki Murakami's latest book, the one with the sex scene where he likens a woman's parts to a enameled pepper grinder, kind of hits the low point for me.
Okay.
And but Lainey Taylor's Daughter of Smoke and Bone trilogy and her Strange the Dreamer duology, her writing is beautiful. People have described it as purple, and that's not really the case, because purple's usually very overwrought. This is just very lush.
Mm.
And yeah, it definitely has a literary feel and quality to it, but it is predominantly fantasy fiction. She's not out there saying she's a literary writer or anything.
Well, there you go. I read neither of those books and therefore cannot comment.
Yeah, I think there can be a thing. I really don't want to turn this into having a pop at literary fiction either, because literary fiction I love is like amazing.
Yeah.
But I think there can be a thing where you focus too much on style to the point where it's not so much that you don't even have substance, it's just you even obscure your substance with it.
Yeah.
And you forget that the first tenet of using words is to communicate.
Yes, and I think therein lies the rub. So they say. That is the function of words at their most basic and, you know, their most important role is in order to communicate, and to communicate a story of some kind. So, I mean, the prose itself, you know, it can be plain and perfect, it can be rich and rare, you know, astonishing and purple, but it has to tell the story. At least it must if you're writing for any kind of audience.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm certain there are writers out there who write weird experimental stuff just for them, and it'd be incomprehensible to anyone reading it.
Yeah.
And that's fine. But if you want to write for an audience, then yes, Madeline's absolutely correct. You must tell the story.
Yeah. It needs to be consumable in some way. It's one of the interesting things about poetry, I think, is that... And I've read I've been reading a little bit of it recently, and sometimes the language can just be so abstract that if you were to look at it in terms of just line by line, or even to try and look at it in terms of as a whole, you would probably struggle to find meaning. And then you look at it word by word, and look at the small, short images that each, you know, line has created. And suddenly it's a series of events that begins to unfurl, mixing between things that are real, things which aren't real, things which are felt inside. And it starts to paint a picture in ever more detail. And for me, truly beautiful poetry is... down to the individual word and the way that they mix together.
Yeah, definitely. And poetry's, you know, a good example. Songs as well. Mm. Songs that really work for me lyrically are the ones that don't give you everything straight up. Songs that really spell things out for you can be fun, but they're, you know, they tend to be sort of more poppy, and, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. But they are, you know, they're candy.
Yeah.
They're not a satisfying meal.
Yeah.
And it's the same with poetry. Poetry can be sort of very surface level.
Mm.
And I don't find that a particularly satisfying experience. I want poetry to make me work a little bit.
Yeah. And I also think that poetry and songs as well, the ones that I like are the ones which they do tell a story, but they actually kind of also reach inside of you and they tell your story, because each individual word will have a different meaning for you, which is particularly why I think some poetry, you know, people will say, well, that doesn't make any sense to me, and then to someone else it's, no, it makes perfect sense, and you find yourself in it instead. And so being appreciating things in each word at a time, you kind of play a little game of word association, really, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. So other things, okay, literally going back to sort of writing prose, things that words should do. Obviously, its most basic function, it must tell the story. It must be a vehicle for the story. Words should also convey character.
Mm.
And that's not quite the same thing as just telling the story. And by conveying character, we don't mean he was a nice person. Yeah. She was a nasty girl kind of thing. It can't, you know, that's like the surface level poetry where it's kind of like, well, that's all on the surface, why should I bother kind of thing.
Exactly, yeah.
But in conveying character, say you're writing third person omniscient, and how you're writing it will give you a flavour of the characters. Now, I'm going to be like mentioning Jane Austen quite a lot because she was an absolute master of this. But for example, if you take her description of Sir Elliot in Persuasion.
Mm.
And she says vanity was the beginning and end of his character, and it's like, ouch, that's one of her nastiest zingers everywhere. But she doesn't ever say that again. It's not kind of like, because he was this kind of person. it's just shown in lots of little vignettes all the way through. The fact that the things that he obsesses over are appearance in anyone. He'll give unsolicited grooming advice to people.
Yeah.
He'll comment on someone's looks. So, you know, it's clearly a thing. And he becomes this ridiculous character all the way through Persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if you were writing in first person, how your narrator speaks will give clues to their character, but also to someone else's character. It's just once removed if they're giving clues to someone else's character.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, sorry, I'm still reeling from that description. Damn, Austin.
You've kind of got to admire the fact that when she decided to be bitchy, she really went for it with all guns blazing.
Yeah, she was not afraid.
Like, there's very few people I wouldn't like to get into a battle of wits with, but Jane Austen might actually have been one of them. On a smaller scale, words can also set up and explore theme by echoing it on a smaller scale, is a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
So, again, Jane Austen. I've talked about chain of association before.
Mm.
And that's whereby you use a word which evokes another image in the reader's mind or the listener's mind. So, for example, in Mansfield Park, which is largely a discussion about slavery and wealth and privilege and sexual exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a romance, guys. You'll find these repeated images, like the fact that when the cousins are doing plays and things, they keep choosing plays which have black characters in them. So they're constantly bringing this up. You've got the main lord, or whatever he's called, forgotten now, I'm afraid, who disappears off to the plantations. There's the link between the church and the chain.
Yeah.
There's all these constant repetitions of that sort of imagery all the way through. And yes, she was forced to do it because she didn't want to end up in prison for criticising the church, the government, and the slave trade.
Yeah, which is not great, to be honest.
But this is a technique that you can absolutely use in your writing. So, I mean, I think the first time I really hit on this was when I was in an editing group with a bunch of other people, and I described, it was for I Belong to the Earth, and I described Hayes' smile as he smiled right, white and sharp, I think is what I said.
Mm-hmm.
And someone else in the group immediately went, wolfish! And I'm like, yeah, that's what I was going for. I was going for a chain of association. So you think wolf, you think predator, you think this is not a good guy.
Yeah.
So, and that's a very simple one. That was before I really had my writing legs on.
Yes. Yeah, make a difference.
you really don't have to be Jane Austen to pull this off. This is basic stuff. If you've got a reasonable command of the language, and you think you could write, he smiled in a threatening manner, and that has less of an impact than saying he smiled white and sharp, kind of thing.
Yeah, it's one of the fundamentals of show, don't tell, really. That is. That's how you can do it as well, is just through very simple language. Incredibly simple language and simple word choices, which do make all the difference in how everything is perceived.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you really don't have to empty out a dictionary to get your point across.
Though you can.
You can do. Probably shouldn't.
No, probably shouldn't.
Words also convey voice.
Mm.
And, you know, we touched on this a little bit, but the voice of your narrator, whoever that is, the voice of your characters, who hopefully
you do know who they
sound
are.
Like you.
Yeah.
Hopefully you know who they are. I mean, that's the thing. People say, you know, you need to find your voice. Well, there is. There's your voice as an author. There's the voice of your narrator, which will not be exactly the same. There's the voice of your characters. You're doing a lot of voices as a writer, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And a good word choice will definitely help you with that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And as Jules says, it does make all the difference through association. It's also why, it's going to sound really silly, when we were kids, not my brother and I, not Jules and I, I should say.
No, that happened at completely different times.
Different times, different periods.
Different timelines.
when my brother and I were kids, we used to play a lot of word association. It was a game my mother really enjoyed playing with us. And, you know, at the time, you know, when I told people later on, oh yeah, we used to play word association, I was like, isn't that just that thing you do, like, psychiatrists do? Like, and I was like, oh no, is this, have I been sort of, like, bad? Conditioned? And then I realised that actually it's been so incredibly important in terms of my development of loving words. And that sounds so spectacularly nerdy, but it is true.
No, not at all. I mean, you're too young to remember Mallet's Mallet, aren't you?
I don't know what that is. You could be saying anything at this point.
Okay. This was a early 90s kids TV show on a Saturday morning presented by Tim Mallet. And there was a game called Mallet's Mallet where it was a word association. And you'd have two kids on, and basically he'd give them a word and they'd have to come up with an immediate association, and they'd go to the next one. Right. And the one that stumbled then got bopped on the head with the mallet.
Right. Okay, so just straight in there with the abuse. Got it.
I think part where it sort of fell down for him was that most of the kids wanted to be bopped by the mallet more than they actually wanted to win whatever the prize was that week.
Understandable. So incredibly understandable.
He got in the habit of having sticking plasters, and he'd either put them on the forehead or the chin, and then he'd sign them for them, and they'd be thrilled. I mean, I've never seen any.
Yep, to be honest, I can completely understand that.
I feel like this has explained a lot. But yeah, you're absolutely right. The word games you play as a child, I Spy and things, it gets you thinking about words. Mm-hmm. The riddle games I used to play with my father, which, you know, makes me sound like I've come from the Da Vinci Code, and I really, really haven't. It's something my
the
dad
riddle
and I
games
like
I used to play with my father. So
I realised how bad that sounded after I'd actually said it. Okay, whole story. When I was 9, I was scratching around for something to read, which seems to have been the story of my life up until I started making my own money and buying my own books. Mm-hmm. And my dad gave me his copy of The Hobbit to read, and I sort of, you know, went through it in about a week.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty fast considering sort of the prose in The Hobbit now.
Yeah.
And I was particularly taken with the scene where Gollum and Bilbo are kind of like talking about riddles in the cave, you know. And Gollum clearly wants to eat Bilbo as well, so there's a lot at stake.
Yeah, a lot at stake.
And Dad and I got in the habit of setting riddles for each other, and we'd make them up and keep going. And, you know, I forgot about it for years until Madeline said something the other night. Suddenly it all came back.
Well, yeah, it was this odd, very peculiar phenomenon whereby I made, what was it? I said, you know, who was it? Oh, that was it. I was putting together riddles for a D&D game, and you suddenly started really coming out with them. And at first, and we went back and forth. And then I thought, well, okay, well, that's that. That was fun. And then around Christmas, out of the blue, it was like, I don't even know what time it was. It was like 10 o'clock at night. I suddenly...
Oh, it was later
it
than
was,
that.
I think it was actually around 11 or something like that.
It was around 11.
Yeah.
And it was the night of the winter solstice.
That's right. And just out of the blue, I get this message from Jules. Which is just this really kind of menacing, rhyming riddle. No context, no preamble, nothing. Just it goes in there and immediately you're like, oh yeah, we're on. Because I knew exactly what she was doing. She was being Mary Lloyd.
So threatening to steal her cheeses.
Yes, that was it. It was in particular was that you were threatening to come into my home and steal my wine and particularly my cheese, and thus we began. I think it lasted for about an hour
It lasted until the solstice turned, yeah.
Yeah.
And then the Marie Cloyd had to be banished.
Marie Cloyd did have to be banished. My final rhyme was to remind her that the rule of the Holly King was over.
Yep. So there you go. This is what we do for a good time, people.
Yeah, Jules and I have the best times.
It's like, forget your nightclubs. I'll just randomly start riddling Madeline quarter to 11 at night. It's going to be a yearly thing now. You wait. The Marie Cloyd is riding again next winter solstice.
I'm so looking forward to it.
I didn't obviously turn up with a horse head on a pole or anything, or a horse skull rather.
No, we mostly because we were in lockdown. But yes, otherwise, so. I wouldn't have put it past you.
No, in fairness. So yeah, all these sort of games and things that you can play are all things that will help. And yes, it can be tricky to start with, but play them a few times, and you'll get going, and suddenly you know you're flying, and you're really getting, not literally flying.
Yeah. But, you know, well, if you are, then there's things. Something else going on, and we can't help.
Yeah,
you
definitely.
With that.
You've accidentally stumbled upon a combination of syllables.
In which case, please do share. We'd be very interested to know.
Okay, so yeah, we definitely recommend word games, crossword puzzles, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Words can also create and enhance and echo mood,
mm-hmm.
Which, you know, will bring us on to the wonderful world of euphonics.
Ah, euphonics. It's that kind of word which sort of sends people scattering away in a panic.
Yep.
I don't know what that is. I don't want to deal with it. Go away.
What is it? It sounds very, very fancy. The thing is, poets have a slightly different definition for euphonics. Songwriters and musicians will also have slightly different terms and definitions for euphonics as well.
Yeah.
We're looking at it from purely prose writing perspective because, you know, that's what we're dealing with today. Basically, language hits on two levels, the conscious and the subconscious. Consciously, when you get a word in front of you, you're picking up on what that word is saying. Subconsciously, you're also you're projecting a written word into a audible sound, usually.
Yeah.
Depending on how you read. I mean, some people read slightly differently, but most people will be looking at it. And because of the way you're taught to read, you may not literally be aware of sounding out a word in your head, but that is kind of what's going on. That's the pathway that's been created.
Yeah.
And why is that important? Well, language...
Yeah, Jules, why is it important?
I will tell you. Language evolved out of two things, necessity and culture. Mm. And it sounds like, obviously, culture should have come a lot after necessity, but this isn't true because these two things kind of went hand in hand all the way up since we've been living in caves.
Yes.
Since we started having a verbal language. You know, necessity, it's literally the immediate desire to communicate an immediate problem and come up with a fairly immediate solution.
Yes.
Such as, you know, Grog, there's a saber-toothed tiger over there, for example. You might want to think about running away.
Why is he called Grog?
We'll get into that in a minute as well.
Yes.
Why did I pick Grog? There's a good reason.
That's a good reason. I look forward to hearing your reasoning.
So yeah, that's the immediate desire to communicate an immediate problem for an immediate solution.
Yes.
Cultural influence is subtler, but generally it shows that something is evolving right at the very beginning. So you're looking at the roots of language, the evolution and progression of a people and their relationship with their home or where they've come from. For example, there is, and I'm terribly sorry that I don't remember the name of the tribe, but there is a tribe in sub-Saharan Africa who have something like 32 different words for green.
Mm-hmm.
And if you show them a palette of green, you know, sort of green squares.
Yeah.
With very, very minimal distinctions between the shades, they can pick out nearly all of them, you know, with no problem whatsoever. Whereas us in the West, we can't distinguish a lot of the time. So they're very good because their language and their perception of that particular colour has evolved at the same time and created that pathway in the brain.
Mm.
It's not been necessary for us.
No.
So we cannot do it to the same level. Quite often we can't distinguish between two very slightly different shades of green, even though that distinction does mathematically exist.
Yes.
So there's that entire sense of culture. But then they have difficulty, if you gave them blue and purple, they would have, we would consider two very complete different colours. They have difficulty distinguishing between the two because they've had no real need for those distinctions.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
It makes total sense. It makes absolute sense. And it is very interesting how something so simple can be so intrinsically tied with language. But again, when you do think about the fundamental of language as the ability to communicate, it is going to be so intrinsically linked with the culture and the environment that you happen to exist in. There's a great quote, and for the life of me, I cannot remember who said it or what. I read it the other day and I was like, oh yeah, and I've completely forgotten it. But it was actually about translation and how there is, the moment you translate something, you are kind of betraying it in some ways.
Yeah.
Because language isn't just something which is translatable. And it's also actually linked to the way that we teach language in the UK, which is actually a really terrible way of teaching language, not least because you start too late, but also because of the way it's taught. It's taught as a translation of English. So you get an apple, you say, this is apple. Apple is bum, rather than saying concept of apple is bum. So it's the moment you have to put anything through a filter, you start to skewer it. There are certain things which are not going to translate over, which have different cultural meanings and also different cultural associations. And that's the really, really important thing, is that the cultural associations are the things that you just can't translate. You can do approximates, but you can't translate them exactly.
Yeah, I'm going to pull you up a little bit there because we're going to get onto that bit in a minute.
I'm sorry.
Racing ahead.
I got excited. I apologise.
So what we've basically looked at is, culture and language and necessity, that the three pillars, basically, they go together. Three parts of that particular triangle for mm-hmm. verbal communication.
Yeah.
All heavily influence each other. Language actually has the ability to influence your perception.
Mm.
I can't stress that enough. And when we go to talking about foreign language, we say foreign languages, other languages than English in a minute. We'll get into that a bit more. Euphonics works on a subconscious level. This means that certain sounds evoke certain feelings in the reader or listener. And I should think that, considering there are many, many, many languages in the world, the sounds that evoke those feelings in English, for example, might not evoke quite the same response in, say, Spanish.
Yeah.
Or Chinese, or whatever. Mandarin.
Yeah.
So that's something to bear in mind if you decide to write your debut novel in Mandarin.
Though there are, I think, universal sounds as well which evoke Definitely. Certain feelings, like the ah being something which is quite soft, mostly probably because it's one of the first really sort of the vowel sounds or enunciations that a child makes is mama. Or, I mean, because...
Yeah, generally, most children are better with dada.
Yeah,
dada, it's easier for the soft palate to make that noise.
Yeah, dada, but it's the A. I mean, in Japan, it's haha for mother, dada, mama, baba in a lot of places, it's baba. So it's the A sound is really considered quite soft. It whenever you hear something which has a lot of R in it, it tends to be quite a soothing sort of sound, but not always. But yeah, it will depend, as you say.
So for other examples, a double E or an E type sound generally is associated with a feeling of suspense or even creepiness. So if you think of the words like eerie, secret, creak, shriek kind of thing, there's a reason.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about grog. Why did I say grog? It's very telling that I said grog, because I was thinking of your typical, and actually, you know, it's typical in Zeitgeist. It's not actually typical as in this has actually happened.
Yeah.
Typical depiction of a caveman, someone who's a bit dirty, overgrown hair, monobrow, club, rawhide, and the gr type sound suggests dirt and degradation and being a bit crude.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's obviously not how I knew that I thought of the Cro-Magnons. If I'd been thinking Cro-Magnon, I would not have gone with grog.
Jules often thinks about them.
I do actually. It's fascinating. Jules often thinks about lots of really random stuff, gotta say. it's like the b type sound. if you have lots of b type sounds in words, one after the other, you inject a sort of humour or slapstick type feeling.
Yeah, you do.
There are loads. I mean, we can't go through an entire thesaurus of sounds because there's just no space. But, you know, there are books on this. Go and have a look or think about your favourite words and think why they evoke that and what the sound does to you. And go from there. But that's basically what you're doing.
Yeah, and it is. I mean, okay, so, all right, here's a question for you, Jules. What's your favourite word, just sound-wise?
I don't know. It sort of changes on a daily basis.
Okay, what's a word you like sound-wise?
Today, celerity.
Celerity? What does celerity taste like to you?
It tastes like a little bit like elderflower. As in sort of elderflower cordial, but not as sweet.
Okay, I can get that. I can get that. Yep, I can totally get that.
And, you know, it means speed and clarity, so...
There you go.
There you go. So my word of the day is very much like, it's word of the day and it will be something bizarre. Today, it's celerity.
I like that. My word of the day isn't in English.
Oh, I didn't know you were doing other words, other languages, but...
Sorry.
In which case, I've had quite a few.
I think my word of the day is kokoro.
Yeah.
Which is heart in Japan, and Japanese. And sorry, that sounds so... But I just really like the K sounds. I really like K sounds.
Okay.
Fun fact about me.
So yeah, just to recap before we go completely off-piste, basically sounds work on a subconscious level to evoke mood and feeling, and you can use that in your writing. Basically, don't think you need to write this in your first draft. In fact, maybe not even your second or third. This might be something you want to add for a final polish.
Mm. Absolutely, yeah. But it's good to develop those skills and that appreciation for words. It is fun. It is fun. And then once you start to find it fun, that's it. That's you stuck forever. You'll forever be a word nerd too.
Yes. Welcome to the team.
Welcome to the team.
Okay, so moving on to other languages than English. Now, native English speakers benefit from having a world that is more set up for them than it is for people who don't speak English as a first language.
Yeah.
It's a privilege, and many of us can be very lazy about it.
Yeah. Which isn't great.
It isn't great. And as Madeline said, it's absolutely right that other languages are not taught well here.
No.
In the sense of, it's a case of, well, English is your starting point, therefore we will translate English into French, German, Spanish, or Mandarin, you know, the ones most commonly taught at school.
Yeah.
Mandarin is actually a common one now.
Doesn't surprise me.
So, yeah, and it doesn't work like that because different languages have different mindsets attached to them.
Mm.
And I think I included in the recent book is if you only have one language, you only have one mindset.
Mm.
That's not a slur. That's not to say, you know, you can't understand or empathise with other people. It just means that you've got a filter and you can only really look at the world through that particular filter, because language is that intrinsically tied to mindset and culture.
Yes. I guess it's also about the way that you... It might very well explain actually why some people don't understand other cultures or really struggle to understand other cultures. And it's because they are trying to translate it into some equivalent. You know, say, oh, so like that's like our... Okay, so a good analogy would be like saying a mosque. Oh, that's like a Muslim church. And if you wanted to translate it on the most basic level, you could say, yeah, because what you mean is it's a religious space. But it's a completely different thing. It has different significance. It has, you know, it's different on loads and loads of levels. And that's a language thing, and that's a cultural thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to take a little bow into some Irish now, just as an illustration to show you what I mean by the mindset thing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, Madeline speaks other languages as well, so she knows. But assuming, listeners, that you are not if you are a predominantly English speaker, and you know, maybe you've got a bit of secondary school French or what have you, or German.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's lots of different... Just trying to think about how to explain this. See, I'm already tripping myself up because I'm thinking how to explain it. Okay, if you were in the Kerry sort of area, chances are someone might say to you, Nachtu, which means, is it yourself? In which case you would say, is me, because it is you, hopefully. If it's not you, then that conversation is off to a very, very confusing start. However, if you were to go to the Connemara area, they say, Kedahuivthu, which means, what people are you of? So the importance when you're introducing yourself is completely shifted.
Mm. Yeah.
And, you know, I'm sure we've got nuances like that here, depending on a situation, but we rarely think about them because we're used to communicating in just one language.
Yes.
So, for example, let's look at the word field. We'll look at two simple English words, field and stone.
Okay.
So we'll start with field. Now, field in Irish can be one of many, many, many different words. So here are a few examples. It can be a ghimhar, which is a cornfield.
Yeah.
It can be a tour, which is a field for keeping cattle in at night. It can be a bal, which is a field for keeping cattle in before you've milked them.
Mm-hmm.
It can be a plasog, which is a sheltered field for a mare in foal. It can be a radling, which is a games and dancing field. Or, and you'll like this one, Madeline, it can be a catherin, which is a field with a fairy dwelling in it.
Well, you've immediately got my attention.
If we're looking at the word stone, for example. Now, the simple word for stone in Irish is cloch. A carrick is a rock. A meinie is a finger stone. A boilg is a submerged stone just off the shore, likely to be dangerous to ships. A sleen is a flat stone. A spearken is a sharp stone. And again, there are dozens and dozens more. What I'm getting at here is that when you've got a language like Irish, which quite frankly, even if you look at Sin Gaidelic or Gaidelic, which is Old Irish, they're very, very similar.
Mm.
Basically, if you can read modern Irish, you can probably read Gaidelic because it's actually simpler. That's a language that's been spoken for 3,000 years. There's a reason there are so many different words for land and stone and ploughing and field, because the culture is tied up with being a people who are tied to the land and survival in that way.
Yeah.
And you know, as we move on and we get, you know, more and more modern English and things, obviously we lose some of those words. There's lots of words in English that we've lost because they're not relevant anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, language obviously has to evolve. It has to be practical and usable.
Yeah.
But I think it's very telling that we've lost these sort of words, like there's old English words that, you know, we don't use anymore when we do use other words.
Mm.
The old English word, the old English word geese became yes. Geese actually means if it is willed.
Mother.
But now we say yes. And it's like goodbye. Goodbye is actually a slurration of God bide ye. God goes with you.
God be with thee. God bide ye.
Yeah, I'm not going to see you for a while. I hope God looks after you. That was literally the mindset, but it's changed now. It's just bye. Now it's kind of like, I don't care, you'll probably be fine. You're unlikely to die of a horrible disease in the next 24 hours. Mind you, considering at the moment, but you know.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that's a big assumption there, Jules.
This is a big assumption. Sorry, there's a pandemic on, but you know, in theory. Yeah, you're unlikely to get set upon by bandits on the road kind of thing.
But you never know.
So, I mean, that's just me talking about the mindset in Irish, and you know, there is still very much, even for Irish people who don't speak Irish, there is still very much this strong connection with the land. Mm. It was something that I experienced when I used to visit Ireland as a small child, was the sense of homecoming. This was a place that I was part of and belonged to.
Mm.
Because there was this immense connection with the land. And I think, you know, we talked about my descriptions of landscapes and things in books, and it's come from that. It's come from that part of me, that Irish part.
Yeah.
So, you know, this sort of stuff runs very deep. And I'm not saying that language shouldn't evolve, but I think we should know what it's evolved from. We should kind of keep an eye on it.
Yeah, I would tend to agree with you. And I do think that one thing that's really fun for me, and again, I'm showing off my nerd here, is actually looking at words in terms of actually what they actually mean in their most sort of basic forms, you know, their most basic parts. Because you look at their most basic parts and you find other words like Sherwood Forest, for instance. Sherwood means the white wood, Sher meaning white. And then the moment you know that, you suddenly go, oh, Sherlock. Sherlock means of the white hair or of the pale hair. And I get ridiculously excited by all of this. I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah, it's the doubling as well, the doubling effect. So Sherwood Forest, why would it be called Whitewood Forest when wood and forest are synonyms? When in fact forest is not actually a synonym of wood, it actually means open parkland belonging to the king where you can go hunting.
Yes.
It's like the River Avon. It's like, well, Avon is actually the Saxon word for river, so we called it the River River. Apparently, you know, invaders turned up and went, what's that called? And they went, well, it's an Avon, obviously. I'm like, oh, well, it's the River Avon kind of thing.
Yeah.
Obviously with Normans.
it's the Terry Pratchett thing, which was just, they would just grab a local, point at it and just go, what is it? Which means that things are just called things like, if another one of these idiots grabs me again, I'm going to throw him in it, river, and stuff like that.
Basically, yeah. So, yeah, it's really interesting. I suppose that sort of leads us to, if you choose to set a piece of writing somewhere that, you know, isn't really your native land, the place you come from, or, you know, have strong connections to and you don't intend to visit,
mm-hmm.
or you're unable to visit, then you should be doing your due diligence.
Yeah.
And that includes a look at the local language. I've just written a book set in Romania, and I don't have them going out for fish and chips every night. They eat Romanian food.
Yes.
They go to Romanian places, which are spelt using Romanian spellings.
Yeah. I think the other thing to do is actually, if you really want to get a grasp of language and you can't read the language yourself, look a little bit into the culture, but also see whether you can find writers fiction, even if it is translated, fiction from that particular, from someone who's in that culture. So translations of let's, I'm going to just use Japanese as an example. Read some Japanese fiction, some actual Japanese fiction. And that can be both read fiction which has been translated from Japanese or read fiction which is by Japanese writers. Because it will also give you a sense of, tonality is the wrong word, but spirit, I guess, without sounding too cliche.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And, you know, things like travel blogs. Travel blogs are your friend.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, no one can really travel at the moment, but there's no reason why you can't find something on Google Maps, have a look at it, get in close, you know, work out distances and things like that. Look at the cultures and things. Look at what languages they speak. I had no idea that they spoke about 15 different languages in Romania until recently. And Romanian is only one of them.
Yes. They like to keep people on their toes, that's for sure.
And then you look into the history of why, and it was, you know, it's really interesting the way it's been settled and the different, you know, different parts of it ruled by different parts of Eastern Europe and things at various different times.
Yeah.
And it was really handy for me because I'm like, one of the languages spoken was German. And I was like, great, I speak German. I can put some German in. This is excellent.
Jules gets excited once again by the possibility of languages.
Exactly. So, yes, if you start writing great long passages of something and you don't translate it for your readers, then potentially that's a bit pretentious, and that's something that Charlotte Bronte got picked up on when she was writing Villette. So there you go, it's been a problem for a long time. But on the other hand, if you're not ever trying to sort of give this flavour of a different place with a different culture and different language, then mm-hmm. you're potentially being a bit lazy. I read a book recently, which I'm not going to name, but it was set in Ireland during the sort of around the time of the Norman conquest of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
It was a fantasy, so historical fantasy, and it should be fantasy first. I found it offensive because, yes, there were historical inaccuracies, which was already annoying, but the way things like the Irish language was used, the way that, you know, the mythology and things just been cherry-picked for the bits that was easily pronounceable in English or had been changed so that it could be pronounced in English. That one really sort of set my teeth on edge, and I was not the only person who read it from an Irish perspective and went, that's really not okay. This is written by someone who lives in America, who's never been there and has done this in this way, and yet is claiming in the author note that this is all fine because, you know, her grandparents were, you know, half Irish, what have you. It's like,
yeah,
you should have done more research.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I can also really appreciate the idea of trying to explore your culture, you know, sort of a country or a culture through writing and things like that. And I can also appreciate that sometimes people make mistakes. They misunderstand things, or they take things from the wrong kind of source material, and if you're surrounded by something as well, you may think, oh, that's just the standard, even though it isn't. But at the same time, once again, it all comes down to due diligence, it all comes down to research, and it all comes down to understanding the basics of the importance of words onto themselves, and that words cannot just be translated. Simple concepts can, simple things like, you know, like an apple. If it's, you know, an apple in all countries, it's an apple. But then, of course, there's different types of apples, so there's that to think of. There's different types of snow, so that's to think of, you know. But also when you then start to get to words which are untranslatable. I think my favourite, and I've definitely mentioned this before, is le... le voix de vide. The voice... The call of the void.
Yeah.
L'appel de vide. That's it. L'appel de vide in French. The call of the void. You don't have that term in English. And it translates to something very specific, which is actually a human thing, not a French thing in particular. It's just something that came to mind. Yeah. Which is, of course, that weird desire you get when you're up in a high place to throw yourself off, or to throw things off of high places.
Yeah. It's like a lot of German compound words. Yeah. And, you know, in fairness, I can understand people looking at modern Irish and going, oh, why is there a block of four consonants in the middle? How do I say that? And the easy answer is generally you skip those consonants.
Yeah.
The reason they're there is so that in written Irish, the person reading it can see that it's a compound word. Just like in German, we have compound words. It's not as terrifying as it looks. If it's an unfamiliar Irish word, I actually literally have to sound it out, because I don't speak Irish in conversation to people every day, strangely enough.
Yeah.
Basically, everyone who I would have spoken Irish with up until, you know, fairly recently, they're all dead now. There's no one left for me to talk Irish with. So I need to find more Irish speaking friends. Anyone wants to volunteer? Let me know. It's like setting something in India. You wouldn't call your main character in young Indian boy Robert or something.
Yeah.
Probably.
Well, yeah, it depends on the circumstance, but yes.
And you wouldn't just define him as being Indian, because he could be part of any member of the caste system. He could be from any religious background.
Yeah.
You know, there's a complicated social strata there.
Yeah. I mean, it's like... depending where you are, of course, you know, you could say, oh, they're northern, like which part of the north? No, you've got to be specific.
Yeah, definitely. Being a Geordie is very different from being from Yorkshire, for example. Yeah. Both still technically northern.
Yeah. Being from Newcastle is gonna be different from being from Yorkshire. So it's worth noting that there is just as much, you know, diversity and difference across the board, and that language is at the core of that, really.
Definitely. This is where I put in my pitch for you to learn another language. Now, hear me out. Forget what it was like at school, because unless you happen to really, really jive with it, you may well have struggled.
Yeah.
A lot of that is to do, it's not really taught in a logical way.
No.
I think it's supposed to be logical, but it's taught as if it's maths or something like that, and that's not what language is. It should be taught as though it was functional.
Yeah.
You can learn a new language in 5 minutes a day if you want to. That's all it takes. And you don't have to say it to anybody else. You don't have to practice it to anyone else. This is just a brain exercise.
Hmm.
And I guarantee if you get to sort of 3 months of doing 5 minutes practice a day in a language, and it can be any language you want, you can learn High Valyrian if you want to. In fact, you can learn that on Duolingo. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
You can learn Klingon.
Yeah, it doesn't surprise me.
This is basically a challenge for yourself. This will help you with your writing, because your linguistic acumen will improve. It'll develop the part of your brain that is concerned with linguistics. You don't ever have to use it. You can choose whatever language you want. You can think, I want to learn Italian because I think it sounds pretty, but I'm probably never going to go to Italy. That's fine. Just learn it. If you like the sound of it, that's also okay.
Yeah, you are allowed. You're allowed to enjoy language.
Exactly. It doesn't have to be a really hard slog. It doesn't have to be something that you achieve in just a month, what have you. And maybe just do it because you like it, you have an interest in that language. And once you've managed to get sort of 3 months through one, you'll find that learning others are a lot easier.
Yeah. I also highly, highly recommend that for some people, you know, they try and think, right, well, I'm going to tackle learning to spell it at the same time as learning to do everything else. Don't do that to yourself. You don't have to do that to yourself. You are allowed to just, you know, learn a language in terms of actually learning to speak it first. Or at the very least, just even for the first few lessons, listening to the way it sounds before you even try to start writing it. That's okay. You're allowed to do that.
Yeah, definitely.
You're allowed.
We've never lived in a better age for people learning languages, and it can be something really obscure if you want to, but there are podcasts out in those languages that you can listen to. I mean, we have a following in India, and I'm pretty sure that the reason we have a following in India is because those people are learning English by listening to our podcast.
Yes. And you really can actually learn quite a lot in terms of language just from listening to stuff. So,
yeah, definitely. So, you know, challenge yourself. This is not something you have to do or share with anybody else. Just do it for fun for yourself, and you'll be surprised how much further along the line it gets you in terms of writing.
Yeah. And also, I think the other thing is that the other thing that always makes me laugh is whenever it's just they're like, well, I'm really struggling to learn a language because I'm really bored in it. Because, you know, all the stuff that we're learning, you know, all the books or the things that are from that are really boring books. Watch a movie with subtitles if you have to.
Do that, or get hold of say you wanted to learn German and you like urban fantasy. There are loads of German translations of great urban fantasy books.
Yeah.
In fact, there's lots of urban fantasy just written purely in German. So, you know, get a book you like, read a page a day.
Yeah. Even if it is a slog, you can write to enjoy things. It's allowed.
Yeah, and it should. I think it really should be fun. If they made it fun at school, a lot more people would stick with it. And you're right, we start too late over here as well.
Yeah, you really do. I've never really understood it, because the optimum time to learn a language is when you're young. It really is, so.
Yeah, that doesn't mean you can't, if we've got listeners in their 50s and 60s, you can start now.
Yeah.
Nothing's stopping you.
Nothing's stopping you. All the encouragement from Jules and I here.
So, learn another language. And if you want, come and tell us about it. We'll be, you know, even if it's not a language we speak, we'll be really interested.
Yeah, we'll be thrilled. Come and tell us. Tell us what languages you're. And also, by the way, just an open invitation to anybody. If you have any cool words, particularly in other languages, please tell us. We'd love to hear about your cool words. That sounds so nerdy, but I am being 100% genuine. Tell me your cool words. I want to hear them.
Okay, before we wrap up, let's just do a little bit about the respectful use of language.
Yes.
Which, you know, is kind of a bit of an umbrella thing. And I touched on this a little bit with the Irish book the book set in Ireland I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, some languages are endangered. And all languages have borrow words. Irish has borrow words from English. English has borrow words from French and German and Latin and pretty much every other language everywhere.
Yeah.
Taboo is actually a Maori word, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, language has to be allowed to evolve. But it's not acceptable to pillage words from anyone's language, especially if it's an endangered language, just because it sounds exotic.
Yeah.
You know, you shouldn't be doing that without understanding what you're using. Another example, I'm afraid it's another Irish example. Someone was on Twitter recently talking about how she wanted to write about the Pirate Queen of Connaught. And she said, but I'm going to write her as Grace O'Malley because it will be more accessible. And I didn't get involved in this argument, but I immediately felt that sense of offence again, because here was, you know, someone coming in, an English person, saying, well, I like this Irish character, but I'm going to write her as with an English name, despite the fact her English name has no bearing whatsoever on her Irish name. Her Irish name is Grania Nic Mahil. And yeah, she was a pirate queen. Her nickname was Bald Grace, because she cut her hair off in order to join her father and brothers at sea. And this was during the reign of Queen Elizabeth, and she harried the English coast and the English ships, and did actually eventually meet Queen Elizabeth. So she, you know, she's a very colourful, interesting historical character.
Mm.
The fact that this person was kind of like, I'm going to change her name to an English equivalent, was so incredibly, unbelievably tone deaf. She did bring the wrath of Twitter down on herself, unfortunately. But it's exactly that sort of thing. It's not okay to just go, well, I'm going to take this culture and this person and I'm going to anglicise it because it will make it easy for me.
Yeah. I mean,
we see this happening with Native American myths as well, and that's another big sort of, it's not really okay because so much of that is endangered or piecemeal now.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and there are ways, if something is, you know, potentially difficult for the native English reader to read out loud, there are, you know, techniques that can be employed in order to help them with pronunciation.
Yeah.
By even just having your character not be able to say it and someone spell it, you know, spell it out for them, which is something I've used plenty of times for Irish.
Even I've used it.
Yes,
I think I used it in I Belong to the Earth for Kieran because my editor could not, she thought it was a soft C. Of course, I immediately was, I was like, of course it's a hard C. It's Irish. Irish is hard C's all the way, kind of thing.
A soft C, not in my language.
But yeah, she had a point. So you need to say it in a way that people understand. I did not run the thing where I just changed the C to a K to make it easier and therefore anglicised, and it really bugs me when I see that done. I admit there's a lot of problems here that are kind of mine, but my point stands.
Yeah. I can understand some anglicisation, but there's a line and you've really got to ask yourself, is it actually that hard? Do I need to change it?
With a bit more effort, could I perhaps, you know, even if you provide a pronunciation guide, which is more and more done now.
Yeah. Again, does make a difference.
Definitely. Authenticity should be balanced with empathy.
Nice, concise way of putting it.
Well, on the one hand, I can understand if someone is writing something set in 1950s, 1960s South in America, why the sort of racial slurs that would be bandied about then would kind of, you know, because they were used so much by almost everyone that they were kind of almost a background noise, and why it might feel inauthentic not to use them. On the other hand, a vast proportion of your readers are probably going to be black and possibly from that descent. So, do you actually need to include them or can you make it authentic in another way?
Mm.
That's kind of what I'm getting at there. And there's lots of examples for other things as well. So, I mean, words that aren't necessarily going to offend me on the page might really hurt somebody else.
Yes.
Particularly if they're words that they've heard all their lives, kind of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is really worth thinking about. That words, and I think this is also the crux of the matter, because words have so many different meanings for different people, you do have to be conscious of the fact that a word which for you doesn't have that much significance, for somebody else, it could be huge. It could be incredibly hurtful. It could be, you know, have so many negative or positive associations as well. And that is the beauty of words, but that's also the curse of words, is that a word will mean a different thing to different people, and you should be conscious of that.
Yeah. It's like the P word used for people of Pakistani origin over here.
Yeah. Which,
you know, I don't think I've heard anyone use that casually since the 90s. Mm. Me personally, that's not to say it doesn't happen.
No.
But it is absolutely, you know, not an acceptable thing to say. The other thing to consider is obviously that your slur word might be someone else's identity, so you have to be respectful of that as well.
Yes. Well, it's like some people, they cannot bear the word queer.
Yeah.
Whereas for other people, it's a huge part of their identity and they do not want that word taken away from them because it means so much to them. And for some people, the idea, you know, using it is about the repression of the gay community, whilst for others, being not allowed to use it is a strict repression of the gay community, or the LGBT community, particularly for those who are trans or, you know, non-binary, as well as being homosexual or whatever. So words matter. I guess I can't stress that enough. Words matter.
Yeah, they absolutely matter. And, you know, it's the same for disabilities and things. I don't actually mind the word epileptic. It was very interesting to get a lecture from somebody who was not a person with epilepsy, mm-hmm. lecturing me, telling me that I was not allowed to use that word in reference to myself, not to somebody else, but to myself. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure I get to use it if I want to.
Wow.
When I'm talking about me.
Are you serious? Someone was just there like, no, you're not allowed. That's insane.
Yeah, apparently I'd internalized a lot of ableism about myself and I really needed help.
Oh, no.
No, I wouldn't necessarily run straight to using that for someone else who also had epilepsy, mm-hmm. Because they have the right to define how they want to be referred to.
Yeah.
But if I say I'm okay with the word epileptic, because to me it's no more stigmatized than diabetic, and I would actually like to see it more destigmatized because, you know, having epilepsy has affected things like my ability to get a job and hold on to it and things like that.
Yeah.
So I would actually like more people to understand it better, and thereby not making the word verboten, I think, would actually be really helpful. That's just my opinion.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
I don't expect everyone else to live by that rule, obviously. But,
yeah.
You know, I reserve the right to use it about myself if I want to.
Yes. That's how I feel about the word queer. Weirdly enough, sorry, this will sound like a tangent. I was, I had a meeting with an agent yesterday, actually, and they had read sort of my description, and they said, just out of curiosity, what is a queer neurodivergent person? And I was like, oh boy!
Oh dear. Hooked the white whale here.
Let me explain. So yeah, that was my little adventure of the day.
Definitely. That's not to say that there aren't people who sort of do word roundups and start making big groups of words verboten without actually understanding the etymology of the word, and the fact that actually, while it might have at some point been used to refer to certain people, it hasn't mostly been used to refer to them, and it wasn't invented with them in mind, and therefore that word is still free, kind of thing.
Yes. But yeah, as I said again, words will have different meanings for different people, and what's important is that you respect that. You don't necessarily have to allow it to govern how you choose to use words, but that you should respect if someone, you know, turns around and says, that's a word which is part of my identity. They are just as valid as someone who says, that's a word which I personally find offensive.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. The example over here in the UK would be the word gypsy, where many Romani actually prefer the word gypsy over Romani.
Mm-hmm.
But permutations of the word are not acceptable, for example.
Yeah.
But in America, that's not the case, and it is as bad as the N-word kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm willing to respect that, as long as America's kind of willing to respect the opposite, which doesn't seem to be the case.
No. It's I think another example of it is South Africa. South Africa, you can be black or white, or they use the word, and I'm just going to have to say it, they use the word coloured.
Yeah.
Now that obviously has a completely different context in America.
Yeah.
But in South Africa, and I was listening to comedian Trevor Noah, fantastic comedian, who was basically talking about his experience, because in South Africa, it basically means someone who is mixed race, someone who has a white parent and a black parent, or who are part of a community who are mixed race. And so it's one of these distinctions. They don't see it as offensive. It is an identifier, in the same way that Latino might be an identifier or et cetera.
Yeah.
And so actually it was a part of his identity. And then he comes over to America and he started using that word and everyone's like, no, don't refer to yourself as that. You know, don't refer to yourself as that. And he was like, okay. And it was a cultural thing, which I thought was really interesting the way they did that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's more than we can hope to unpack here. These are words that have grown up around situations that have happened, which I suppose brings us to the "but that's how it really was" but realism kind of thing. And the only thing I'll say to that is I think people assume that there were periods in history where everyone was okay with something like slavery or genocide. That has never ever been the case. There's never been a time when everybody was kind of like, yeah, we think this is a jolly good idea, let's get on with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
There were protests in Britain against the atrocities of the British Empire in India. There were protests in Britain against us arriving in Virginia and trying to take over Native American land. There were protests against the slave trade. We know there were. That doesn't exonerate, it's not to say that we don't inherit the guilt of our forebears. We just don't.
No.
That makes no sense. That's kind of eye for an eye territory, and then you're just as bad as the people who did what they did to your ancestors. But at the same time, we can't pretend everything didn't happen. But in addition to that, you have to look at all history, and nobody was all good. I mean, for example, there was, during the 18th century, the 10,000 to, 100, no, I think it was 100,000 white slaves were sold out of Europe and Britain into Morocco to build palaces. And they very specifically asked for white slaves because they were exotics. So there has been a rampant white slave trade as well. It's kind of, you've got to be careful with slurs and things, because a lot of them have come out of this sort of situation where one group of people are trying to make another group of people less than they are.
Yes.
If you absolutely have to use a slur, then try to put it in a character's mouth and try to have it challenged on page. Honestly, if you're writing about sort of, you know, slavery in America during the 18th, 19th century, then I don't know. Leave it up to you. I think if you're a writer, there are creative ways you can tackle that problem. Still show the racism without minimising it, without actually having to resort to using words that actually don't have any good context.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not an easy one. How do you maintain authenticity whilst also, you know, not, you know, using words which are hurtful or harmful, things like that. And I guess, once again, it all comes down to research. It all comes down to research. It all comes down to understanding fully the implications of the words that you are using, particularly if they're not your words.
Yeah.
Traditionally.
Absolutely. So,
there we have it.
Words are fun. Words are potentially dangerous.
Yes.
Words are fun in many, many languages.
God, we're such massive nerds.
We are. Etymology is good. You're just lucky I didn't go off on a real old English rant, because I could have filled up an entire podcast with this word used to be
Not
this.
Not going to lie, I was expecting it, but it didn't happen. So not quite sure what to say to that.
Maybe I'll save that for if we ever get stuck for an idea. It's like, oh, we'll just do an hour of me talking about old English.
Oh no!
Half an hour of debating about what the word "wheat" means.
If anyone would like that, please do let us know.
Anyway,
anyone is super keen to hear Jules
be ranting about words in a language that we don't use anymore. Okay, well, before we go, it's time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation, and this week Madeline has one for us.
I do have one. So I have been watching a series, it is available on Netflix, called Demon Slayer. First and foremost, this is not for the faint of heart. I say that because there is a fair amount of gore. It's not gratuitous, sort of, but it, certainly in terms of, I wouldn't be recommending it to very young children. It is a really, really good, it's a really excellent series. I've really, really enjoyed watching it so far. I haven't finished season one yet, so, you know, I cannot speak for how it ends, but certainly it is incredibly popular, and it follows a young, without too many spoilers, it follows a young boy named, I've just can't believe I've just forgotten his name.
You could make up
Tajiro.
I was going to say, you could make up anything and I wouldn't know, because I've not watched this.
Who basically, in the first episode, and again, I'm just going to have to spoil the first episode to give you the premise of the story, his family all get murdered horrifically by a demon. Except for his sister, his sister who was closest in his age, who gets bitten and is turned into a demon. In this case, it's sort of a little bit like vampire lore, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But she's able to control her urges to kind of just kill everything and everyone in order to eat and feast. And he embarks on a journey to basically transform her back into a human. She's with him. And to do that, he basically has to become a demon hunter. And it's actually very good. I really have enjoyed it. I love the characterization. I love the humor as well. There are some really subtle moments of humor, in particular this main character who seems quite straight-laced and then every now and again will just come out with these very small kind of dry statements. Like he's in the middle of a battle and stuff like that. And you just think, you know, he's talking about, you know, he's like, oh, and he's talking about someone's technique and he's like, also, I hate to say it, but that thing they do is really gross. And I'm like, that's not what you should be concentrating on at this moment. You're about to die. And also the fact he's like, also, I'm really sorry, but I kind of find the fact that you have eyeballs in your hands just a tiny bit gross. He's a good boy. He's very sweet. It's a good series. I highly recommend it.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
And on that note, guys, we will say thank you very much for listening. Once again, do get in touch with us. Please let us know the words that you like. We do love to hear about words. You can get in contact with us via Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr, either individually or through our Dissecting Dragons page. For now, we'll say, everybody, stay safe, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note that no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.